From KCRW, this is Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiotakis with a show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Today, we're climbing into a mobile medical van parked outside of a homeless shelter in Long Beach. Inside, a wiry, soft-spoken shelter resident named George Godfrey is getting a checkup.
How you doing this morning?
Dude, I'm doing great, Mr. Godfrey. How you doing?
I'm hanging in there.
How's this place treating?
Ben Koska, a physician's assistant for the nonprofit Healthcare in Action, pulls up Godfrey's chart on an iPad.
Now, let's see. I understood that you went to the podiatrist, which is the foot specialist.
Yes, foot specialist.
How did that go?
It went great.
Yeah?
It went great. He cut my nails and stuff and cleaned my feet, and I got to go back in 2 months.
Wonderful, because I remember you were having that very sensitive spot.
Yeah, it's still sensitive. He's trying to clean it to where I got a coin where they cut my toe off for the cancer.
Koska practices street medicine, a growing healthcare field that allows doctors to meet and treat unhoused residents where they live. Popularized during the pandemic, mobile medical teams like this one are becoming a lot more common in L.A., and as KCRW's Zoe Matthew explains, changing state regulations are making it easier for them to provide care to LA's most vulnerable.
A simple trip to the doctor's office can be a time-consuming or even risky affair for people who live outside or in a shelter.
Every day, your primary thought is, where am I going to eat today? How will I get my clothes clean? How will I wash my hands? Where will I use the bathroom today? And how do I have to time that?
Cindy Manginelli is the director of community engagement for the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council.
When life is full of tiny little detail questions like that, then it can be certainly overwhelming to think about, oh, and what am I going to do about this wound I have?
As a result, many people experiencing homelessness don't seek healthcare at all. Despite the fact that most unhoused Californians are eligible for the state's free insurance program, fewer than a third of those enrolled have ever seen their primary care provider. But living outdoors and in shelters is hard on the body, and waiting until health issues turn serious can result in things like extended emergency room visits or mild conditions that become life-threatening. In LA County, the life expectancy for an unhoused person is around 30 years shorter than that of someone who is housed. Health issues can also make it much harder to get housed.
We see a lot of people that their health is what has resulted in homelessness, and their health issues also are what keep them from being able to get back on their feet again.
To break down barriers to medical care, street medicine teams try to meet unhoused people where they are, providing treatment and exams in the field and at mobile clinics. In Los Angeles, a number of these teams cropped up during the early days of the pandemic, when federal funding flowed freely. Back then, they were mostly focused on providing vaccines and COVID treatment. As that need waned, some tried to expand their practices to address the many other pressing medical needs they saw on the streets. But they faced challenges getting reimbursed by insurance, says Brett Feldman, co-founder of the street medicine program at USC's Keck School of Medicine.
When you bill Medi-Cal or Medicare, you bill for what you did and where you did it, which is the place of service code. And there was no place of service code to indicate the street. So even though what we were doing was fully reimbursable, because of where we were doing it, we couldn't get reimbursed.
Recently, that changed. In November, the state made it easier for many street medicine providers to bill for their services. New benefits also make it easier for them to act as patients' primary care providers. Feldman says the results have been promising.
Already, these policies have just absolutely exploded the number of street medicine programs in the state. We did a California landscape analysis on street medicine this past summer. At the time, there was 26 street medicine programs that we knew of. Now, I know of 45 and seem to be finding new ones almost every day. I just found another one yesterday.
In LA, he's watched the number of teams double from 6 to 12 in just a matter of months. Having a more reliable source of funding has allowed street medicine teams to visit with clients more regularly. And some are even beginning to offer more specialized care, like gynecological services or treatment for chronic illnesses like HIV. In Long Beach, the Healthcare in Action team drives around making visits to encampments and shelters 5 days a week. They specialize in treating older adults, one of the fastest growing populations of unhoused Angelenos. When Ben Koska started with the team in February, he was seeing patients out of the back of his own pickup truck. Now, they have a specially outfitted Sprinter van stocked with supplies.
It has everything that a normal medical clinic would have inside. We have an EKG machine, we have an ultrasound, a centrifuge if we need to draw labs and spin them down before we take them to the lab. We also have a lot of point-of-care devices, so we can check hemoglobin for anemia, hemoglobin A1C for diabetes. We can do point-of-care hepatitis C, HIV testing.
Koska met George Godfrey 7 months ago, while Godfrey was staying in a Project Room Key motel set up to provide emergency housing during the pandemic. Before that, getting to doctor's appointments was a literal pain for the 60-year-old Long Beach native. He doesn't have a car and uses a cane to get around due to knee issues and an arm he lost as the result of a childhood injury.
I be in pain, I hurt, I can't get around and do some of the things that I would like to do because it's like I'm getting slower.
Now, the team drives their clinic to meet him for regular checkups. Even though he's moved to a different Long Beach shelter, they can coordinate transportation if he needs to see a specialist or bring specialists with them. Today, occupational therapist Rachel Kent is along for the ride.
I'm gonna get you another shower chair like you had at the other spot.
Okay, thank you.
Is that helpful?
Yes, it was.
Okay, great.
Because I was able to sit down. I showered. Standing up is rough.
I know.
I'm barely able to stand. My legs are getting weak.
I hear you. And then in the shower, it's slippery.
It's slippery, yeah.
Exactly. Okay.
It's pretty hectic. Mm-hmm.
Other staff members keep in close contact with patients to help connect them with social services. Some of them have experienced homelessness themselves, which Koska says helps to build trust.
They have a unique skill in working with this population, whether it's their own personal experience or a family member or a long history in this industry. And they are our secret sauce.
LA's growing network of street medicine providers is also getting a boost from local funding. The city council just gave USC's street medicine program $1 million to expand their partnership with the city. And a county street medicine fleet launched during the pandemic is becoming permanent. They now have 60 full-time staff members and 4 trucks. Medical Director Absalon Galat says the new reimbursement rules help fuel the expansion.
It did allow us to dream of a little bit more for our program. Envisioning of what the ideal should be.
Of course, anyone in street medicine will tell you the best thing you can do for the health of someone experiencing homelessness is to get them housed. And Brett Finn from USC says it's important for that housing to accommodate medical issues they might still face.
There's a lot of sick people on the street. So if they need assisted living or a nursing home level care, then that has to be built for them too, with facilities that are willing to accept them.
It made a big impact on 68-year-old Geraldine Barnes. She was unhoused for 30 years before she got a room at a newly opened supportive housing site for seniors in South LA.
Well, this is my bathroom, my bedroom, my closet, my kitchen, and my living room.
When she arrived, she was in bad shape, suffering from severe arthritis and other ailments.
Got tired. Tired, walking and, you know, not eating well, lose weight. I lost a lot of weight, you know. And then I got in the shelter, I lost more weight because the food in there was nasty, processed food.
Her new apartment has special accommodations for mobility issues. And the food is better, too, because she cooks it herself.
I cook beans and neck bones. I cook. Now that I got the food to cook, I can eat every day. Every day, you don't have to be hungry no more.
These days, Barnes mostly spends her time watching TV and relaxing. She says it's helped her body heal.
Now, yes, now I'm very good. I'm not in pain as much, you know, and I'm more happier here, you know, and I'm just grateful right now.
Because at the end of the day, there is one thing that 10 out of 10 doctors agree on. You can really only be so healthy when you don't have a roof over your head. For KCRW, I'm Zoe Matthew.
Just ahead on GLA, new rules in LA over how you will cook in your new home. Do you prefer cooking with gas, which has environmental repercussions, or have you converted to electric, which isn't quite as flexible, or at least hasn't been in the past? You're going to hear about it on the other side of this.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. All across Los Angeles, it's the question a lot of folks are asking, gas or electric? You may be thinking that I'm talking about cars. Let me try it again. 3, 2, 1. Onward now with Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. And all over Los Angeles, it is the question a lot of folks are asking, gas or electric? You may think I'm talking about cars, but no, this isn't about wheels. It's about burners. Because as of the new year, new building construction in the city of L.A. must use electricity, not gas, for most appliances. That's for new construction homes. But there are exemptions, like restaurants for now, at least, and emergency facilities going forward. So no more cooking with gas inside that house, but cooking with volts. Stephen Cooper is principal designer and owner of Cooper Pacific Kitchens. That's over in the Pacific Design Center. Hi, Stephen.
Nice to be involved today.
And John Eric Concordia. He's a chef at home and at work where he owns the Park's Finest Barbecue over in Echo Park. Hi, John Eric.
Happy New Year.
Stephen, you're the guy in between policymakers and consumers here. What are you hearing from folks about this change?
Well, it's definitely something that's been coming for a few years. It started, I believe, in San Francisco, came out with regulations a few years back. City of West Hollywood, the city of Santa Monica, have also adopted similar measures. And the application of that at first was to multi-unit, 10, 20, 30, 40 unit apartment buildings, condominiums, high rises, that sort of thing. I think we do expect it to hit single family homes. I know the city council voted on this last year to bring that same type of regulation into new family homes in Los Angeles. So there is a bit of a question as to the adoption date of this, but we can definitely expect to be thinking about this for new construction going forward.
New construction going forward. Do you find yourself, Stephen, in the role of salesman, or do you find yourself in the role of missionary here, isn't trying to sell or promote the virtues of this, new electric stove technology like induction that we see out there right now?
Yeah, I think I wear several hats, one of which is not only designer, but also educator. And I think that, when we hear about electric cooking, like the first thing we think of is those old red coils on grandma's stove that, would take several minutes to heat up and would be hot for an hour afterwards. The electric cooking we're talking about with induction is a very, very different animal. It's higher tech, it's precise, it's quick, and it's a very different thing relative to probably what a lot of people think of when they think of electric cooking.
John Eric, how do you feel about this as a chef? Because I know, and I grew up in the restaurant business, I know that a lot of chefs, a lot of cooks in the kitchen, they like gas.
The thing is, regarding the technology and advancements in cooking, it's something that we find ourselves continuing to learn from. For us, cooking with gas has been something that's cheap, affordable, and easy to maintain, especially with the organizations like the gas company or people that can repair our units. Now, for us, we smoke barbecue, so we use wood pellets, but we do understand that there's new insight on how gas, natural gas, and methane and carbon dioxide are affecting people's health. So we totally understand that, but the dynamics that you deal with, especially with cooking, are some elements where the kiss of fire is a part of the flavor. So, for example, steakhouses, where you're able to sear a steak using a broiler. Even Asian cuisine, using woks to cook, using a high heat and a high flame. So it's part of it is, you know, for a lot of bakers now, they don't use gas ovens because electric ovens are more consistent, and you know, they just find that the quality of their product is a lot better by using an electric convection oven. But we do understand, I mean, sometimes when people start a small business, they get hand-me-downs. You know, sometimes they're buying used equipment. So having the capital to be able to start a business becomes extra difficult. And, you know, there are criticisms and critiques about how people and small mom and pops can run businesses in cities that have these ordinances that are looking out for people, but also trying to consider what are we trying to do if we're trying to create, you know, small businesses for the city.
So, Stephen, how do you respond to people who prefer that kiss of fire, who prefer cooking over a flame?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I think there's a very distinct conversation between residential applications and commercial applications, such as restaurants. You know, if you think about just the footprint of individual homes versus restaurants, I understand that, you know, in the residential market, your business isn't riding on the type of cooking you have generally. It's what we're used to. And I agree with John Eric in terms of the type of cooking does demand an open flame oftentimes. On the residential market, I think it's more about what we've become used to and what we're comfortable with.
This is an environmental thing, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, that's where it's starting with. Is it
bad for the environment? Are we talking about CO2 emissions? What are we talking about when we're talking about gas? Why is it so bad to have gas ranges and stovetops across LA or anywhere?
Yeah, I think it is about the CO2 emissions. That's where this is coming from. Climate change discussions are a big part of that. And, you know, if we think about gas is a relatively inefficient means of heat transfer, if we want to bring it down to that, relative to something like induction. There's a tremendous amount of energy that's lost when you have an open flame and you're cooking your, boiling about a pasta, for example. And that's where that's coming from, is the loss of energy, the emissions, and all these kind of things that are not only being released into the atmosphere, but also, I think, as the homes become more energy efficient, we're sealing them up more. There's also a concern of indoor air pollution. So some of those emissions, in our older homes were a little bit leaky, and you had more airflow in and out, where now we're getting those sealed up in almost a tight wrapper, if you will. And I think there's also a concern about indoor air quality for the residents of any home.
John Eric, have you done much cooking on an electric stove?
We've utilized electric stoves for community cooking demonstrations and events, festivals and events. We've also, in our family, my aunt still has her electric stove. So we're familiar with it. And we also understand that, especially with, air emissions inside homes, some people have to use their stove to heat their homes. So the dangers with that are real, especially in small working class communities. But one of the dynamics that we deal with is the infrastructure of, parts of Los Angeles that still have Victorian homes, have craftsman homes, as well as market rate housing that's built right next to them, but we didn't fix the infrastructure of the power grid. So we were affected by that just recently, September 1st, during the heat wave, the grid popped. We had to shut down operations. We had to safely traverse and get people out of the restaurant and safely home while the streets were blacked out. And that reoccurred multiple times the following week. So the dynamics of that, too, is how do folks have an even chance to cook their food if there is no electricity available?
Do you hear a lot of that, Stephen?
Well, I think it's, we, living in Southern California, especially in the summer, I think we've all been either subject to or warned of, power downs and brownouts and things like that. So I think that's a definitely a
something that needs to be addressed. I think the mechanism is a good one. I think it is about induction cooking. If we go back to that and think about why are we doing this? There are some bigger topics to tackle, I believe, that John Eric brought up. But when you look at the actual cooking element, an induction range or an induction top, the ability to be precise and consistent and have absolute control is immense. I mean, it's a great tool to have. I think there is, like anything, there's a learning curve that's going to have to be adopted. But it is it's a really good way and a very precise way to have control over your meal. And, from melting butter without burning it to boiling water extremely fast. And there's also child locks and safety features that are built into it, Wi-Fi enabled features. So I think it is very much a new technology that it's been around for a bit, but I think the adoption curve is going to certainly take on more and more power over time. But it's one of those things too, where I think, we have a bit of a connection to cooking over fire that's part of our, human existence. And I think that is part of this debate, is people just don't feel comfortable with it. They like the gas aspect. And I'm talking residential cooking now. I think, John Eric is approaching it from a business point of view, and those are two very different needs and topics. And I think, in my opinion, there should be some difference in regulations that is handed down by the city that isn't affecting commercial establishments as like it would residential.
And a lot of those residents, it's not just a gas stove or a range, it's also a gas heater, right? Or a gas clothes dryer, which we also see as well. Those are also a part of this, right?
Yeah, I mean, you've got your gas water heaters. There's a significant part of our home that is driven by that. And I'm sure, one at a time, these things are going to be addressed by the local building departments.
I want to thank you both for coming on and talking to us about it. Stephen Cooper, principal designer and owner of Cooper Pacific Kitchens. John Eric Concordia, owner and chef over at Park's Finest Barbecue over in Echo Park. Thanks so much. Happy New Year to you both.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Stay dry. Bless y'all.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, a solar energy boom in the desert is making for a fight over what the desert is actually for. Renewable energy amid those seeking respite in the wide open. That's tomorrow on Greater LA. I hope you can share your thoughts with us. Tell us how you're doing this new year. Give us some story ideas, too, at our website, kcrw.com/greaterLA. And while you're there, we'd be honored, I say, if you subscribed to the podcast, kcrw.com/GLA. And of course, you can get that podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Juliana Mayo, Nihar Patel, Sonia Geis, Ted Robbins, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Christine Camito, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all helped put the episode together this evening. I'm Steve Chitakis, burning for you. Have a great night. And I'm burning.